you are in fellowship and continue on here dealing with verses 7 and 8. Life is pleasant and it is good for the eyes to see the sun. And as we point out here that in spite of all the things that Solomon has observed in this world, many of which would undermine the principle of happiness to a great degree, he has not seemed to give in to this. He has not seemed to reject the idea that man can be happy, that he can be blessed, and that he lives in a world of God's creation. These things could, at one level, yield frustration, but at another level, if one understands them properly, they yield some comfort, that God is indeed in control, that the world isn't spinning out of control as it seems as it is, that God has ultimately thought through all of this and knows that this is the way it will go down. So 23 here, we're ready to resume with the exposition of this. In spite of his own admitted lack of complete understanding, and Solomon has acknowledged that no matter how smart you are, no matter how wise you are, no matter how much you think through it, no matter how much you observe, no matter how much you meditate on the facts and consider these issues and ruminate, you're not going to come to a full and final answer of why things are the way they are. And at a certain level, again, very much to me, this whole book has just said you have to have faith in something, whatever it is. And I think Solomon would counsel his readers to have faith in God and his plan. So in spite of his own admitted lack of complete understanding, those verses 7:27 and 28a, and 8:16 and 17, Solomon refuses to succumb to depression and or discouragement. 24, he counsels his readers to maintain a hopeful outlook, to employ due diligence, to plan ahead optimistically, and to avoid the dangers of selfish living. Well, that whole section there was essentially his great experiment. He tried every form of anything that would make a man happy, we would think. And all the things that men think will make them happy, guess what? They don't make them happy. I said, I will test you with pleasure. Well, that's a good place to start, isn't it? If I'm going to conduct an experiment on myself, let's start with the pleasure part of it first. And so Solomon did. But Solomon had, again, the idea that he had such resources, that there was nothing he couldn't try. So enjoy yourself, and behold, it was futility. I said, of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? And this is spoken by somebody who laughed a lot. Now, you might read that and say, well, why is he saying this? Well, because he clearly laughed a lot. So one would assume Solomon was relatively happy at some level. And yet he says this is not satisfying ultimately. What happens? With all laughter, it ends. You can hear a good joke and you laugh. And guess what? Pretty soon you quit laughing. It's back to life as normal. I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine. No doubt if Solomon had access to them, who knows if he did or not, I wouldn't have expected him to limit this just strictly to alcohol. Any pleasure that would be brought, I mean, Solomon probably wasn't snorting coke because they probably didn't have cocaine manufactured at that time. Of course, I don't think it grows in that part of the world, but were there other drugs he might have taken? No doubt. Did he smoke the highest highs and get the greatest trips and have the greatest alcohol and all that? Probably so. What was available to him? I'm not saying everything was available to him. It's available now. Man's been pretty good at figuring out those plants that get you wasted. I was watching old Boston Legal the other day, you know, and this was a judge that imported these two plants from wherever it was, South America or somewhere, and apparently taken in conjunction with one another, they produce an intense hallucination for 30 minutes, and then you just feel good. And, you know, you really don't want judges tripping on the bench, but one begins to wonder if they aren't anyway, under normal circumstances. But the fact is, this wasn't illegal in this country, but just possessing the two things together was illegal. So Solomon, no doubt, enjoyed the finest of sensory experiences. I don't think he would have denied himself anything. I don't think he had the need to. And so he says, I tried to figure out what good there was. And then he engaged in all these public works and all these great agricultural achievements, all these great building achievements, architectural achievements, and all of that. Possessed the finest things. Again, every night was a better than a Vegas-style show. I mean, it was Broadway every night in Solomon's temple, or in Solomon's house, rather, probably not in the temple, but that would get him into trouble. But in his house, no doubt in the palace, there were tremendous dancers. I mean, there probably isn't, Shakira probably had nothing on these women, if you know who that is. And if you don't, well then, you don't. But guess what? He had all this great money, tremendous treasure, everything a man could want, and gave himself every opportunity to enjoy it at every level. And lived the life, again, that most men could only even fantasize about. And at the end of it all, what did he say? He said, I didn't think it was that great. What? Are you insane? Well, no. Once a man lives this experience, he's going to come to find out it's empty. Why is it empty? Because nothing lasts. Everything is transient. Even if Solomon had the greatest sex with the greatest woman that ever lived one night, there was the next night, and the night after that, and the night after that. And so, as he says here, I provided for myself male and female singers, great shows every night, the best of everything. This wasn't American Idol either. He didn't have to stand there and listen to a bunch of twits. He knew who he wanted. He knew who these people were, and he brought them in. And no doubt there was probably somebody in charge of all this. Get the show ready for tonight. And I'll bet you every night it came off without a hitch. And so then he said, I provided this, the pleasures of men, many breasts, breasts and breasts. And if one does not read that and understand sex is in view, I don't know what to do for you. So selfish living doesn't, he said, avoid this. This doesn't last. Avoid foolishness and stupidity. Again, while Solomon minimizes in some ways the value of wisdom, he recognizes that it's relative. He doesn't embrace the other. He doesn't say, well, then just be stupid. 2:13, I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. Avoid one-upmanship. Ecclesiastes 4:4, as he saw there. Every labor and every skill which is done is a result of a rivalry between a man and his neighbor. Quit worrying about keeping up with the Joneses. Don't worry about what people have. Don't worry about outdoing them. Just learn to live in your niche and be happy. On the other hand, he advises against laziness. 4:5, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Then he turns around and counsels against workaholism. The workaholic, the person that thinks I'm going to find happiness and success in my job. And I'm not saying that women never do this. It's probably become more prevalent since, say, the 50s and 60s of the last century than it is now. It was more prevalent now than it was then. But many men go through this. Matter of fact, we talk about that show Mad Men. These guys identified themselves with their job. This was who they were. And to lose their position was tantamount to losing their life to them. And many men go through that, where they identify themselves so much with their job that they pour themselves into it to the exclusion of all else. Their families suffer, and all these other factors that come out of the workaholic attitude. Solomon doesn't counsel people to be workaholics. He counsels moderation in that regard, and he sums it up with one handful of rest, verse 6, is better than two fists full of labor. And all of that. And then he points out that, you know, even if you are a workaholic and you get all this, that you can lose it, a certain man, without an heir, having neither a son nor a relative. And yet there was no end to all his labor. Well, what's the point? He pours it, because he's got nothing else. So he pours himself into this. So Solomon, I think, if one reads this carefully, would recognize a balance to life. A balance to rest and a balance to labor. He advocates hard work, but he also advocates having some fun. And Solomon says, on the other hand, for the person that wants to pursue Funsville, he's going to find out Funsville isn't fun forever. It doesn't yield long-term happiness. He counsels against solitary living. He advises that two are always better than one. That people can help one another. And that there is some advantage to friendship and to companionship in life. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody has to be married or all that. That's not what he's saying. What he is saying, though, however, is that there's no business for solitary living, just to isolate yourself, to become a hermit. That's not good either. And you watch people, and some people want to hole up and just not do anything. Well, that's not living. That's not living, in my opinion. He counsels against excessive familiarity with God there, as he warns him, God does not tolerate fools. He takes no delight in fools. So you better be careful of how you approach God and all of that. He counsels against shock over abuses in this world. Stop being surprised. Do not be shocked at the sight when you see oppression. It's going to happen. He counsels against loving money, against greed, and he tells straight out, verse 10, I won't read all those, but verse 10, chapter 5, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. People think, again, they have these ideas that if I just achieve this, I'll be happy. If I get to this point, I'll be happy. If I get this amount of money, this job, this woman, this man, whatever it is, happiness will be there for me some point. I'm just going to fall into it. But no, it doesn't work that way. So the unbridled pursuit of pleasure, he counsels against that in chapter 7, verse 4. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. He counsels against arrogance, chapter 7, verse 8. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. He counsels against anger, verse 9. Anger is not a healthy... we recognize that there is legitimate anger and then there's sinful anger that just is not healthy at all. There's righteous anger. We call it righteous indignation. When God's plan is being thwarted, when people are standing for wickedness and pursuing agendas that are really evil. Well, yeah, that should upset you. But you even have to keep that in perspective. You can't allow just to give in to it. You're going to end up wanting to kill them. Because you'll recognize that these people are evil and they should be taken out. But you can't get consumed with that. Anger doesn't solve the problems, as James would say. The anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Verse 9, do not be eager in your heart to be angry. For anger resides in the bosom of fools. M, living in the past. Some people, that's the way they approach life. They just, the good old days is all they want to talk about. And this becomes more common as people age and they get older. And guess what? The good old days weren't all that good. But you look back and I look at the things. I mean, I was getting the car washed the other day and they had this, you know, one of these card racks with things, you know, it's got these years and all the things that were going on during the years when you know, and I look back at whatever it was, 72 or something. I was looking at one of them and looking at several of them, you know, and all those things that were popular then. Guess what? They're gone now. They haven't amounted to anything. And people that live in the past. Living in the past doesn't solve the problems of life. Do not say, oh, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this. And inordinate pursuits of righteousness and wisdom. There's a place to pursue righteousness. There's a place to pursue wisdom. There's a place not to recognize your limitations. And people that don't recognize their limitations aren't happy people. They're not going to enjoy life because they're constantly striving for that which is unattainable. Perfect righteousness and perfect wisdom in this life is unattainable. So just assume that you're going to have to live with some limitations. This is good counsel, I believe. All this is very good counsel, that you have to live within limitations. On the one hand, we recognize that in terms of righteousness, the positive believer has a love-hate relationship with his STA. He hates it because he knows the STA doesn't do him any good. It just gets him out of fellowship. And yet, if he didn't love the STA's advice sometimes, we'd never sin now, would we? No, we go with it. We like it. Makes us feel good for the moment. How is it that the STA, I mean, it's the most powerful drug that's ever existed. People come under the control of the STA and they absolutely lose their minds. And that's the danger. And so we recognize that while you have a love-hate relationship with your STA, you have to acknowledge to yourself, you know what, I'm never going to be perfect. And accept that about yourself. And people will put pressure on you. But you know what, they aren't perfect either, nobody is. So you have to look at these things and keep them in perspective. There's a real perspective you have to have with life, I think. And inordinate pursuits of righteousness and wisdom don't get it done. Ecclesiastes 7:16, do not be excessively righteous and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? There's a certain area in which if you continue to pursue this beyond the boundaries of propriety, it's self-destructive. It's self-destructive because let's assume you think you get it. Let's assume you think you've achieved perfect righteousness in this life. Well, you're just going to find that nobody else lives up to it. That's the first thing you're going to find, is nobody else lives up to it. So on the one hand, you have to recognize your STA is an enemy. But on the other hand, you have to recognize you can't get rid of it either. And it's going to dog you every day for the rest of your life. And you're going to have areas of strength in there and areas of weakness. And you're going to succumb to your areas of weakness more often than you do to other areas where you have areas of strength. But you can't get too down on yourself. There's a point in judging yourself and judging yourself rightly. And then there's a point of beating yourself up. What good does that do? How many times have we beat ourselves up, and are you a better believer for it today because you beat yourself up? Probably not. I think there's a point at which it just becomes counterproductive. And so you have to learn how to live with your own failures, your own shortcomings. Well, that's easier said than done, because what's going on in here, nobody knows but you. And you have to live with yourself on a daily basis. I look at some of you and I think, how do they do it? No, I'm just kidding. You may look at me and think the same thing. How does he do it? Well, it's tough. It's not easy being green, I'll tell you what. Certainly Kermie knew. Well, righteousness and wisdom, yeah, we want to be righteous, we want to be wise. But guess what? There comes a point at which it's just not going to happen. And you have to learn, okay, I make dumb mistakes. I've done that. I made dumb a couple of weeks ago for how, I don't know how it happened. I lost my little clicker for my car door. Well, I beat myself up for about 3 or 4 hours. Oh, you idiot. I can't be being careful. What the hell? How'd you do that? Guess what? All that didn't make it come back. It's still lost. And so I said to myself, well, there's a time to search and there's a time to give up as lost. So I looked for about an hour. I thought, well, no, it's not any places I've been, so it's lost. So then I really freaked when I found out the dealer wanted $70 for it and another $50 to program it. I was really beating myself up. $120 mistake, you idiot. None of us have ever done this but me, I know. So that's how I get online. Well, I finally ended up buying one for $24 and programming it myself. And guess what? It works just fine. So I could beat myself up, but guess what? Life has to go on in the meantime. And I can beat myself up for months over losing that thing, but what's it going to accomplish? It's still lost, isn't it? And guess what? I've got a new one now and it works. So what? Let's move on. So perfect wisdom, you're never going to have that either. You're never going to do right in all situations. You have to learn to come to grips with that. And that to me is very sound advice, because it's easy to get into this pursuit of perfection. And perfection's not available to us in this life. It never is going to be. Not until we get to phase 3. Well, he counsels, against having too thin of a skin. Also, do not take seriously all words which are spoken, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Guess what? People are going to say things about you. Some people can be just thoughtless and say stupid stuff, maybe unintentionally. Other people might intentionally malign you, maybe for good reason. Who knows? But the fact is, you can't take it all too seriously. You have to let it just bounce off of you and go on at a certain level. Because you can't change what people think, and you can't change what they say. And as he points out here, the good advice is that you yourself recognize that you've said things that you regret. You've said things you wish you could take back. You didn't mean it. You just said it in the heat of the moment. And so you have to, okay, don't have too thin a skin. People are going to criticize you. And the more you do, the more successful you are, the more you'll be criticized. That's a fact. So you can't let things bother you. You just have to say, okay, well, it is what it is. He counsels against rebelling against the establishment chain of command. He counsels us all people to be obedient. I say, keep the command of the king because of the oath before God. To live in this world, to recognize the political nature of it, and to orient to it. He counsels against not using common sense. We call it common sense, but apparently it's anything but. Verses 8 through 10 of chapter 10. Because he warns us, if we aren't careful, you're going to get hurt by the very things by which you make your living, in some regards. He who digs a pit may fall into it. The serpent may bite him who breaks through the wall. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them. He who splits logs may be endangered by them. If the axe is dull and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Wisdom has the advantage of providing success. So, if common sense, my axe is dull. Stop and sharpen it, stupid. There you go. Pretty easy. So he says, okay, look at the situation, evaluate it, see what it is. He warns against slandering authorities. In your bedchamber, do not curse a king. And in your sleeping rooms, do not curse a rich man. The rich man being not just simply someone who's rich, but someone who's probably, because of his wealth, is in a position of power or authority or something over you. Or there are those people that are just resentful of the rich because they're rich. I resent the rich. Well, what if you get rich someday? You still going to resent them? Probably not. Suddenly the rich will be your buddies. They're hanging out with a different crowd. Well, he warns against that because, let's face it, it's easy for people to fall into this. And the fact is, when you deal with authorities, every authority is imperfect. Husbands, pastors, all of them, any establishment chain of command, royal chain of command, you've all got imperfect authorities. So what's the deal? When I see the authorities imperfect. Well, slandering, maligning, gossip. Well, first, that doesn't solve the problem. You still got an imperfect authority. Secondly, it does not lessen his authority over you if you're indeed under his authority. And what good is all of that? Plus, it may bring you, that's the whole point, it may bring you, there appears to be a sort of divine way in which God lets this stuff get around. See, people think they're doing this in a vacuum and that nobody knows about it. Wrong. God says, I'll make sure the word gets out. People, and again, we've seen that he counseled against the whole conspiracy idea. People can get together in their back rooms and conspire to do all that they think they want to do. But you know what? Ultimately, God can thwart it all in nothing. And then, plus, make sure the authority finds out about it. And then once he does, the king may not be quite as amenable to you as he was before. And one thing, of course, in an Oriental monarchy, you never want to be on the wrong side of the king, not even for a second. Because the king exercised absolute control. And nobody exemplified this more, of course, than Nebuchadnezzar. We saw it there in Ecclesiastes, that head of gold, or not Ecclesiastes, Daniel, that head of gold. So he says, okay, don't do that. Don't hoard your possessions, Ecclesiastes 1 and 2. He warns against that. Counsels to appropriate charity and appropriate wisdom in terms of sharing what you have. And again, because why? The receiver today may be the giver tomorrow, and vice versa. And this strikes at human arrogance. You have to be able to receive as well as to be able to give. Divide your portion to 7 or 8. Be pragmatic about it. Look, you don't know what's going to happen. You may need some help someday. Well, it's best if you've helped others. T, excessive planning that leads to inactivity. That actually, she probably also, I should have included verse 4, because that's the deal there. The guy who's watching the wind, guarding the wind, is trying to figure out the optimal time for action. And he's going to think through it, and he's going to mull it, and he's going to get it all just right. No, he won't. He says that may lead to inaction. That's the whole point. Waiting for the optimal time to do anything may lead to no activity at all. The optimal time may never come. So he says, sow your seed in the morning. And do not be idle towards the evening. So the excessive. So he counsels against a lot of pretty, I think, very practical stuff that we need to know and think about. 25, one very obvious reason for counseling the enjoyment of the present provision, as well as the active participation in life, is that we will certainly not be able to enjoy anything under the sun after life is over. 9:10 just says it straightforward. That whatever you find to do, do it verily. Do it with all your might. For there is no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you are going. And Sheol there is probably nothing more than a figure for the grave. The word could be used in a number of ways. But I think Solomon, as life under the sun is viewed as over, and when it's over, you go to the grave, and that's it. Now, I'm not saying Solomon didn't believe in life after death. He clearly did. But that's not germane to his book. He's talking about how do we live life in the here and the now. He doesn't say, he's not concerned with what you're going to do in phase 3, because that's not germane to his reason for writing. His reason for writing is to counsel about how to live life now. Well, 36, it is clear from Solomon's viewpoint and from what we know of mankind in general that life is considered to be superior to death. Deuteronomy 30:15. And again, while people get tired and they say, I'm tired of life. I wish I didn't have to live anymore. I'd like to be in heaven. Well, sure, we all would. But does that attitude, and there's a sanctified groaning that we have that we recognize from the New Testament, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, awaiting for the adoption of sons. While that groaning's going on, can't we enjoy life as well? You still desire to be clothed with your permanent house. But what about now? And again, there was that old Fundy expression, some people are so heavenly minded, they're no earthly good. And their focus is so much on the sweet by and by that they forget about the dreaded here and now. And guess what? We all have to live in the here and the now as we go, as near as I can tell. Moments move on, and eventually, yeah, we'll find our phase three home, sure. But what do we do now? And that becomes one of the big issues of life, how to live. Deuteronomy 30:15, I have set before you today life and prosperity, death and adversity. And clearly in those links, prosperity with life and adversity with death, life is viewed as the optimal choice there. Proverbs 11:19 also. So life is viewed as superior to death. This shouldn't be, this point to me is not deep or hard to figure out. I just felt like I needed to say it here. He who is steadfast in righteousness will attain to life. But he who pursues evil will bring about his own death. 13:14. The teaching of the wise is a fountain of life. To turn aside from the snares of death. Their death is viewed as a trap that is designed to take you in and neutralize you. And 14:27, the fear of the Lord is a fountain of life. And there the teaching of the wise and the fear of the Lord appear to be parallel from our previous verse. Because the teaching of the wise is tantamount to the fear of the Lord in this verse, so that one may avoid the snares of the death. So it's good to have a wise teacher. 27, these two verses deal with that specific concept and counsel a lifestyle that recognizes all the above realities, but still approaches life with a realistic optimism. Now, you don't have to be a flaming optimist, a Pollyanna that sees life through rose-colored glasses and nothing is ever wrong. I hate those kind of people, by the way. I can't stand them. I mean, I just want to rain on their parade every chance I get. And then that's the danger, of course, of dealing with the unqualified optimist. Then you may want to just rip him to shreds. Just to show him you don't need to be that optimistic. I'm here to help you. Not so much as you might think. Then there's the unreserved pessimist. Woe is me. Life is bad. I want to go die. Dying would be better than this. That's horrible. And guess what? There's a balance to this between optimism and pessimism. And realism is the better concept. But realism even should have, in my opinion, from a doctrinal perspective, realism should have an element of optimism to it. Do I look to the future and think, oh, woe is me? I'm positive, but God's got nothing but bad planned for me. No, I don't look at life that way. I assume God has good plan. He desires good for me. Everything I read in the scriptures kind of tells me he's benevolent and he wants his people to be happy. And so life here, again, you want to have a realistic optimism. Try to avoid both. And I know personally in my personality, I have to watch it because it's very easy for me personally to look at a situation. Somebody can say, we got to do this and such. And I'll see immediately all the things that could go wrong with that. And that's not good. I mean, you want to look for pitfalls. That's good. But to unreservedly do that is bad. And I know it's bad. It's something in my personality I recognize I don't even like. And so if somebody is happy, I'm going to bring them down. Well, that's not the right attitude to have either. Well, you know. Or if somebody is depressed, I'll run around and act like a Pollyanna just to twit them. Well, no, you don't want to do that either. So you need a realistic optimism that recognizes, okay, God's got me here for a reason. Now, what is it? I don't know. I can't tell. For me, I assume my destiny is related to teaching His Word. I mean, I knew pretty early on, even as a fundy, I knew within the first 2 or 3 months that I was supposed to be in the ministry. I didn't know what all that meant then because I didn't understand it, and I had all these weird ideas that were wrong, and I had to wade through. But God got me through it all, see? He got me through it, and He got me trained like I needed to be. But I had to come to the recognition, even though I was already in the ministry as a Baptist pastor, that I didn't, and I was a Baptist preacher, trust me, I wasn't a pastor. I was a Baptist preacher, and all that that conjures up. And so I thought to myself, okay, I had to come to the recognition, look, I'm not trained, I'm not qualified, I've got to get out of the ministry, in fact. But even then, I was looking forward. I didn't view it as a bad thing. I thought, well, okay, this is good. I'm going to get trained. I'll be qualified, actually, now to teach the Bible instead of just teaching it like an idiot, which is what I was doing at the time. And so I thought, well, okay, then I'll get trained and all that, and then God will provide a church, maybe. I figured he would, in fact. Well, ultimately, he did. Well, life is a gift from God, which can ultimately be lived, savored, and enjoyed. 28, in a sense, it might be called the doctrinally enlightened form of the carpe diem mentality, which is the idea that one should make the most of the present opportunities and enjoy the life that is available. And this is based on the fact that all life and all opportunity comes from the hand of God. And we recognize that. As believers, we should recognize that. And so, does God plan on prospering me in the future? I don't know, but I don't worry about it. Could things happen, and all of us probably know here, unless you've got some really great insurance or something, we're all one accident away from financial catastrophe, probably. I mean, and even if you've got great insurance, we're just one trip and a fall away from not, you know, from being a paraplegic or a quadriplegic. I mean, anything can happen at any time. There is enough uncertainty in life to know. I mean, somebody could be killed in a car wreck on the way home. None of us plans on dying after this that I know of. I don't have it penciled in on my calendar. Oh, by the way, teach Bible class, then die. No, I still plan on living. So we recognize, you know, life is here. God provides it. And we should enjoy it to the extent that we can within, I think, again, the enlightened doctrinal approach is enjoy life, but enjoy it under doctrine. And if you're not willing to enjoy it under the straight and narrow of doctrine, my suspicion is you're never going to enjoy it at all. Because if people aren't willing to humble themselves and follow God's plan, then they're never going to be happy people. They'll have a measure of human happiness, possibly. But and this is coming up again in the doctrine. There's a distinction between fleeting human happiness and true happiness, the happiness that comes from God. The internal elements of contentment and self-satisfaction and all of that. Contentment probably approaches as much as anything a good working word to define happiness. The happy person is a content person. They're not constantly striving for something else. They've learned to be content. And that produces a fair amount of, saves you, number one, it saves you a lot of wear and tear in life, of pursuing junk. And so, are people out there happy? If you go invite, go ask people that have left Bible class, are you happy? You know what they're going to tell you? They're going to tell you, yeah, I'm happy. But see, ultimately, long term, are they going to have happiness? I don't believe so. Because they're not willing to do it God's way. And ultimately, if God is the author of happiness, then you got to do it God's way in order to enjoy His happiness. And that's the realities of doctrine. That's why we have the royal imperatives to check out. Okay, are we doing this God's way? He tells us what His way is. We just have to orient to it. Well, 29, the recognition that life is short and time is fleeting should motivate the believer to enjoy the present moment within the boundaries of God's provision. And that is just, and that's actually very simple. Just relax and enjoy what you have. Now, does that mean that God will never provide anything else? No. Does that mean you'll never buy another detail? No. Sure you will. Things wear out, or you might decide, you know, God may have some blessing for you down the road. It may not be because something wore out. Maybe God just wants to give you something better. But you have to sort of figure that out. See, there's the human element as well. How do I know if God wants to give me, say, a different car or a different house or whatever? How would I know that? I mean, God doesn't come knocking at my door and say, hey, it's time to move. I have to figure it out, think about it, pray about it. But at some level, wouldn't my desires be commensurate at some level with what God wants? I mean, I'm not saying they're perfectly exactly what God wants, everybody. But if you've got desires of your heart, what does the Bible say? God delights in giving you the desires of your heart. For those that delight themselves in Him, though. See, that's the rub. You have to delight yourself in God. That God is the ultimate focal point And that focal point is expressed through living out the royal imperatives. 30, the Hebrew grammar of verse 7 is not difficult. However, the New American Standard has rendered the term mathok, honey, syrup, or sweetness, as pleasant, rather than its basic meaning of sweet. And you can see how they got there. You know, sweet things taste good, they're pleasant. We understand that. So, but not to all people. All people don't necessarily like sweet things. I'm not a huge sweet eater. I eat some, but not very many. Well, 31, the term, I think it's because I'm naturally sweet. Yeah, that's it. The term is used literally to refer to material substances like honey. But the two usages in Ecclesiastes both refer to figurative sweetness. You have our verse we're working on now, and 5:11. I think I got the wrong one. I think it's 5:12. The sleep of the working man is sweet, is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. But the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. Well, one of the advantages to working is, there are many advantages to working, of course, but not there's the satisfaction of a job well done, there's knowing you're in God's directive will, and all these other factors. But one of the advantages is that work actually works for you, in that it works in the physical body to produce fatigue. And when one is fatigued, one sleeps better. And one might say, from looking at this verse on the surface, well, the rich man doesn't sleep because he's full. No, the poor man, the working man there, could eat much, he says. He could have a full belly, but he sleeps just fine. And in some cases, let's face it, the working man, the average Joe out there, we've all heard about him, Joe Plumber, Joe the Plumber, Joe Sixpack, you betcha. And, you know, he when he goes to work, he does his job and he goes home and he doesn't have all the pressures and stuff that the rich man has. Because the rich man's got to figure out how to protect his wealth, how to guarantee the future, how to make sure nobody gets his stuff. And the poor man's not concerned with that so much. And so there's a number of factors in this verse here, but just suffice it to say that this is one of the usages of the figurative use of sweet. People go to sleep and they enjoy their sleep. They wake up refreshed. That's always nice. Don't you like it when you go to bed at night and you wake up about 2 or 3 and you lay there and toss and turn for a couple hours with all kinds of things running through your head? And you wake up the next morning, you feel like crap? Well, that's not sleep, a sweet sleep. That's not enjoyable. So the more pressures, the more problems, the more money you have, the less you work. In some ways, this becomes a danger to mankind. 32, by placing this term forward in the sentence, Solomon indicates that he is not talking about the light as much as he is talking about the fact that the light is sweet. That leads off the text there, sweet is the light. 33, the vast majority of interpreters recognize that Solomon is using light as a figure for life, since one cannot see the light if one is not alive. Ecclesiastes 6:5, he's alluded to this before when he talks about the stillborn, the aborted fetus, says it never sees the sun. In other words, it never lives. It never has life. And it never knows anything. And he says, for those who can't enjoy the life they have, he said, you're better off just not being born. A miscarriage is better than you. And is that harsh? Yeah, it is harsh. But at some level, it's also true. For people who don't enjoy life, you might as well just be dead. And also 7:11, wisdom along with an inheritance is good. And an advantage to those who see the sun. Those who see the sun are the living. That's the idea here. When he says it's good to see the sun, he's essentially saying it's sweet to see the sun. It's good to be alive. Life is good. Not anything you probably ever expected you'd hear out of this book. But yet, there it is. Life is good, he says. And I think Solomon believed that life was good. All right, well, our time is up. We've got to stop early here today because it is our time to observe the Lord's table. So let's stop here and we will get everything in order to observe this ritual.